We're going to open our Rules Committee today, and I thank everybody for being here. It's nice to have a full crowd this late in the session. It's always exciting. Along with that, as some people here, I try most of the time to let people know what we are or are not going to move on a certain day. And there's one group in particular that I feel really apologetic to because they've been coming regularly, and it allows me to make sure that the back row is always open.
Since we like to have a full crowd and everything, why don't you do something different today and just not tell anybody if you're not going to hear it?
That's true. Then everybody will have a crowd. But my understanding is that there have been a number of people working very hard at a solution for House Bill 3498 that would not take legislation, and I've always been one of those that believe that's the best way to do legislation. So we're taking that one off the table today. So 3498, we're going to just take off the table. We're not going to hear it today, and we may not get back. So, and I'll talk to people about that if they haven't heard. 507 and 508A have been a regular staple, and they will continue to be on Friday. We aren't going to have those meetings today. If there's anybody here who traveled a long ways and won't be back for that would like to speak, I can open up a little hearing and let them. So I don't see anybody, so I think we're okay there. So with that, just because my other two representatives who were going to speak to 7 are not here yet, I'm going to open a public hearing on SCR 17. And we'll have a short explanation, and then we're going to let Representative Garrard speak.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Concurrent Resolution 17 congratulates Coach Daniel J. Miles and the Oregon Institute of Technology on the success of the school's men's basketball program over many seasons. Coach Daniel Danny Miles has served as the Oregon Institute of Technology, Technology's men's basketball coach for 38 seasons. During that time, Coach Miles led the Hustlin' Owls to NAIA Division II National Championships in 2004 and 2008. Coach Miles ended the 2008-2009 season with an 847-362 win-loss record and is ranked 7th in wins in the history of men's collegiate basketball at all levels in the United States. Coach Miles was a recipient of the Southern Oregon University Distinguished Alumnus Award in 2005, inducted into the NAIA Hall of Fame in 2001, the Oregon Sports Hall of Fame in 1996, and named National Basketball Coach of the Year in 2004 and 2008.
And if anybody kind of in listening to that has kind of a deja vu experience, as if they'd heard it before, we're going to have an explanation of why that might be. Representative Garrard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Yes, you have seen this before. Earlier in this session, it passed the House 59-0. And unfortunately, when it got to the Senate, no one moved it forward, and it sat there, and so we had to start a new bill at the last minute, and this is it. The only thing I would add to what Jerry has said is that Coach Miles demands at least a 3.0 and has it from every player that's ever played for him. So he values that education as the most important thing, and I would appreciate the committee's indulgence in repassing this out.
So is there any other discussion? There is no one in the audience that signed up, but if this explanation and the conversation from Representative Garrard stirred anybody to need to speak to this bill, we would love to have them. Seeing none, I think we'll close our public hearing on SCR 17. We're going to open a work session on SCR 17. Representative Garrard, would you like to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move SCR 17 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Did we do an amendment?
No.
Not as amended.
Not as amended.
Nope, I'm sorry. Let me reword the motion.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move SCR 17 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves SCR 17 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative
Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
That was an aye.
Oh. Vice Chair Edwards?
Excused.
Chair Roblin.
Aye. With that, the motion passes. Representative Garrard, would you wish to carry this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have anyone here for H.R. 7? It's going to be shopped or whatever. So I'm going to, we'll hold that for a little while and see if they get here. And we're going to open a public hearing on SB 519A. And with that, we'll invite our senator up. And go with a short explanation of our bill.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 519A prohibits adverse employment action against employees for declining to participate in employer-sponsored meeting or communications about religious or political matters. It creates an employee civil cause of action, requires employer to post the notice of employee rights, provides exceptions for religious or political organizations, and for legally required or voluntary meetings or communications. Clarifies that the bill would not prohibit mandatory meetings of the employer's executives or administrative personnel to discuss issues including those subjects covered by the bill. Although current law protects employees from certain forms of discrimination, no law protects employees from being required by their employer to attend religious or political meetings, including meetings concerning union organization, or to be disciplined for refusing to do so. SB 519A outlines specific employer and employer rights related to this subject.
Thank you very much. Senator Rosenbaum, it is great to see you back here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Senator Diane Rosenbaum from Senate District 21, and I'm especially glad to appear for the first time this session in front of the House Rules Committee, a committee for which I have a particular fondness, having served as its chair last session with Senator Roblin and with Representative Berger as the vice chair. So it's great to see all of you today. And I'm here in support of Senate Bill 519A. This bill has been moving quite quickly now. It just passed the Senate on Monday. It did come on the Senate side from the Senate Rules Committee, but originated in a committee that I chair, which is the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development. So I'm very familiar with this bill, and I'm very glad to appear today to explain the bill and also to perhaps give some answers to things that I think you will be hearing from some opposition to this bill. You may remember another bill from last session that looked similar to this one. I want to point out to you that that bill is a very different bill. It did pass the House, did not pass the Senate, but that bill actually dealt with the same types of meetings, employer meetings that would be held for the purpose of religious or political views. That bill actually prohibited these meetings. This bill very definitely does not do that. So this bill is really quite simple. It just says that if employers choose to hold meetings for the purpose of expressing their opinions about religious or political matters as defined in the bill, those meetings have to be voluntary. In other words, if employees don't want to attend those meetings and listen to those points of view, they have the right to go back to work and just do their job, which is what, after all, people are being paid to do. The bill also provides a civil right of action if these provisions are violated. The bill provides exceptions for entities that are businesses that are organized primarily for religious or political purposes so that they can conduct their business without running afoul of this law. And finally, the bill requires a posting to be done of the provisions of the bill. So that's basically what the bill does. I want to talk a little bit about what the bill does not do, because I think you may have already heard some of this, and I'm sure you will shortly. As I said before, the bill does not prohibit any employer meetings from being held, regardless of the subject or regardless of the type of meeting that it is. And this is specifically stated on the bill. We wanted this to be very clear, so we added language, which is on page 2, lines 40 through 43, that specifies that these meetings can be held, simply that the meetings must be voluntary in nature. Participation in them must be voluntary. Second, it does nothing to prohibit an employer from conducting its business. Questions have arisen about, you know, if we need to hold a meeting about menu labeling, just to take a wild example, and we run a restaurant or a food enterprise of some kind, can we hold a meeting and tell people about those provisions? Absolutely. I mean, if that has passed into law and been signed by the governor, that would be part of what the employer needs to communicate. Nothing would prevent that from being held as a mandatory meeting. And finally, I want to clarify another thing that I think is a misconception, that somehow this bill will prevent employers from firing or otherwise disciplining people for matters unrelated to these meetings. This is something that arose pretty late in the deliberations on the Senate side, and so I went to legislative counsel with that question because the language to me seemed very clear that the only thing that was prohibited was retaliating, firing, or otherwise disciplining people because of a choice not to participate in these meetings. And legislative counsel agreed with that interpretation, that indeed was the language and the only way that they could see that this language could be interpreted. They also issued a multi-page opinion. Both some members of each party asked the same question of legislative counsel about whether the bill was preempted by the National Labor Relations Act or in some other way prohibited by law, and we got a very clear answer, which I'd be happy to provide to you if you don't already have it, that no, there was no preemption problem, that cases that were being cited did not apply and were not similar or on point to this. So finally, I would just say that this bill is something that is needed. I think it's a common sense proposition that people go to work to do their job, to do a good job for their employer so the employer can be successful, and that doesn't necessarily include wanting to be preached to about religious matters, about political matters, about things unrelated to their job. And we heard numerous examples, and I think you'll hear some of these stories today of people who had exactly that experience, sometimes including being physically dragged back into their chair when they simply tried to leave and go back to work. So I think it's a good bill. It's one that the Senate has taken favorable action on. I'm hoping that you will be able to do the same in these late days of the session, something that would provide much-needed protection to many, many Oregon workers, and I think would actually make for a better workplace where people feel that they have the ability to do their job and not fear action as a result of things unrelated. So I thank you for scheduling it so quickly, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
I think we'll go to the full panel, and then I think at the end of this full panel, I'm going to break for a second and go back to a hearing. We have a representative here. We'll take that testimony, and then we'll get back into this one. So,
we'll be
go
brief.
For it. Yes.
Mr. Chair, my name is Ken Allen. I'm the director of AFSCME Council 75. We represent 23,000 workers in Oregon, including about 1,500 private sector workers. I've been working in organized labor for over 35 years as an organizer, as a rep, and now as a director of the union. And this is a common sense bill. It's simple. All it says is that employees don't have to stay in these kind of meetings. And I know on the Senate side there was some idea that this is very 1940s, and there was a belief that these kind of things didn't happen anymore. But from our experience, 95% of the private sector union organizing campaigns we get involved with, the employers hold these meetings that are called captive audience meetings. They may hold four or five of them, and they insist that every worker go in them and stay in them. All this bill does is say to a worker, you have the freedom to not go into the meeting. It's a good common sense bill. I want to introduce Hillary Mortensen. She went through a union organizing campaign with our union, and she's going to talk a little bit about her experience. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Hillary Mortensen, and I'm here to briefly share my experience while I worked at Early Head Start Family Centers of Portland and ask you to support Senate Bill 519A. In 2002, November, I started an organizing campaign, or with the help of AFSCME, we started organizing our workplace. And we found that there was a strong majority of support And then shortly after we filed for an election, we had a teacher in-service day, which turned into a captive audience meeting. Nowhere on our agenda did it say we were no longer going to be talking about very pertinent things related to Head Start. We were suddenly talking about how our director would leave if a union came in. She was calling people out publicly, saying that if you supported a union, then obviously you didn't care about the kids, or you grew up in a union family, so you couldn't know any better. It really left very few people who were willing to stand up and continue to express their support for the union. The safest place that people actually had conversations in during the meeting was the restroom, because that was the only way we could get out of the meeting briefly. And unless you felt exactly the same way as the director did, you were publicly attacked by the director, and then your coworkers, those who were anti-union, also came after you. So I don't want to insult anyone's intelligence and go through my whole written testimony, but I would just urge you to support Senate Bill 519A so that workers have the opportunity to either attend these meetings or not attend these meetings. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Seeing none.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're going to open a public hearing on
HR 7.
And we'll have a short explanation while our representative comes forward.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, HR 7 congratulates the Port of Morro on its 50th anniversary. The Port of Morro, located near Boardman, is located on the Columbia River in close proximity to Interstate 84 and the east-west main line for the Union Pacific Railroad. It is governed by a 5-member Board of Commissioners elected by the voters from the Port District. In addition to its marine facility, the port operates 3 industrial parks and the Boardman Airport.
With that, welcome to our committee, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Greg Smith, and I have the pleasure of representing District 57, which includes the counties of Union and Wallowa and Morro and Umatilla County. In the coming days, the Port of Morro will be celebrating its 50th anniversary, and as a consequence of that, or as a result of that, we wanted to back home send a message to the Port of Morro, a thank you and a congratulations on all the work that they do. And so House Resolution reads, whereas the Port of Morro, located on the Columbia River near Boardman, Oregon, is celebrating its 50th anniversary, and whereas the Port of Morro was approved by Morro County voters to establish a tax base of $31,000 for the port after the Morro County Court lent the port $500 to establish a checking account, and whereas the Port of Morro Commission immediately began planning for development of the John Day Pool for river navigation and irrigation to be completed by 1968, and whereas the Port of Morro in its early years began acquiring property for port facilities, accumulating several thousand acres for future growth, and whereas the Port of Morro, after the completion of the John Day Pool for river navigation and irrigation, welcomed the food processing industry in 1974, and whereas the Port of Morro promoted the development of energy facilities and terminal cargo, such as grain facilities and wood chip transload terminals, and whereas the Port of Morro is continuing its energy development with ethanol production, gas-fired power plants, and plans for cellulosic ethanol facilities, and whereas the Port of Morro in 1984 invested in container terminals, and container terminals become the largest barge terminal in the United States, moving approximately 24,000 40-foot containers annually, and whereas the Port of Morro has more than 2,000 people working at port-generated operations, creating over $1 billion in annual gross sales and paying over 50% of the assessed valuation of Morro County property taxes, and whereas the Port of Morro owes its rise from its humble beginnings to its extremely capable and inspired past and present leadership, now therefore be it resolved by the House of Representatives of the State of Oregon that we, the members of the House of Representatives of the 75th Legislative Assembly, on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Port of Morro, extend our best wishes to the Port of Morro and to the past and present leadership of the port. Colleagues, I'd be very appreciative if you could offer support to House Resolution 7. I would share very quickly for the record a conflict of interest, and that is nine years ago, I worked for the Port of Morro.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you. No questions.
Okay, comment. Yep.
maybe to continue a little bit and speak to the resolution. I have never really forgiven the previous Secretary of State when we did the realignment of districts in the state following the last decade that came in. And the reason, I mean, there were a number of reasons for that. Some are political, in which he made life much more difficult for my party than it maybe had been before. But in addition to those political reasons, and all of this is a political reason too, the Boardman and the Port of Morrow, when I first came to the legislature, was in my legislative district. And while I didn't know the folks down there very well, and I therefore had something, I felt of an obligation to work hard to get to know them, and to become familiar with the community. And when I lost that part of my district, I found that I lost a kind of a significant little piece of myself, because the people there, the activity there, just incredible. And the Port of Morrow itself, I still marvel. They have had a great group of directors at the port, and have done an extremely aggressive job of building and marketing their facility. In addition to the hiring of, I think, one of the most capable port managers in the entire Northwest, and that would include in cities like the Port of Portland and the Port of Tacoma and the Port of Seattle and other places. And I've never really figured out how he stayed there, except I think, like a lot of us in the eastern part of the state, you fall in love with where you are and with the people who are there and the job that you have there. When I first came to Oregon back in somewhere along 1967, you could have bought the entire area for $5 an acre. The biggest, I didn't have a lot of money in 1967, but the biggest mistake I may ever made was not taking what little money I had and buying, my share of that little community and that little ground where the port now exists, because it has, as the representative has pointed out to you, the economic growth and activity there is just incredible. Just incredible of what has taken place. So I had to add a few words here of appreciation for these fine folks and for the area and the community, and my thanks to the representative for bringing this resolution before us.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see anyone else that wanted to speak to this resolution. But we're going to close our public hearing on HR7, and we're going to open a work session on HR7. I have a few of my members are going to zip off because of another meeting. So,
Mr. Chair, would you like to be?
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that HR7 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Jensen moves HR7 to the floor with a be adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll do a roll call vote.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes. Would you like to carry?
I would. And Mr. Chair, I'd also like to extend a tremendous debt of gratitude to you for this. Thank you.
Yep. You're welcome. So we'll have Representative Greg Smith carry. Okay. And we're going to close our work session on HR 7. So with that, we'll get back into calling some people up forward. Make sure you get the right list. We'll just go down the list. Charlie... is that Fingers? Thanks. And Georgine Bargan again?
Berrigan.
Berrigan, thank you. And Tom Chamberlain.
Fine, thank you.
Yep. And whichever order you want to go. Okay.
All right, good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Charles Fenger, and I am here in support of Senate Bill, 519A. One of the disagreeable tactics employed by McCall Oil and Chemical of Portland to intimidate us from becoming members of the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific was the mandatory meeting. Not long after serving the company with notice of our demand to be recognized as a union via hand-delivered letter and union pledge cards signed by 100% of the crew, the company issued a date and time for when each employee would be required to appear. The only purpose of this meeting was for the president and CEO to inform us of the owning family's displeasure at our effort to organize. The company's stated position was that we, the employees, were allowing a third party to interject themselves into the company's business. This would only serve to make matters worse. The union would impede the company's ability to run its business, give us raises and benefits, as well as reward deserving employees. In fact, a negotiated contract could get us less than we had now. We would also be wasting our money by giving it to the union in the form of dues. At no time was there any acknowledgement of the issues that drove us to unionize, nor interest in addressing them. So I'd like to point out that McCall Oil and Chemical operates a large, dangerous, and complex facility, 24/7, 365 days a year. The terminal manager expended large amounts of time and energy in an effort to keep overtime down. This, of course, led to erratic hours and days off for the small crew. Not only did this meeting disrupt much-needed time off, but it cost the company money. What made this tactic so striking was that prior to organizing, the crew were treated as red-headed foster kids. There was no contact with the owning family. The only contact we had was from the president were edicts issued by the terminal manager in his name. This mandatory meeting was a clear and blatant attempt to intimidate us not to organize. I would respectfully urge this body to pass Senate Bill 519A so that no other workers in the state of Oregon would have to suffer this abuse of power. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the House Committee, my name is Georgine Berrigan. I am a union member for the Bakers, Confectionery, Tobacco, and Grain Miller workers. I'd like to give you some information on mandatory meetings that were held during a union organizing campaign at Bread Song IBR Bakery this last year. During our campaign drive at Bread Song IBR Bakery in Lake Oswego, I was required to attend 4 mandatory meetings put on by the company. Workers were subjected to the following tactics and information, much of it was false: anti-union videos, threats of benefit takeaways, the ESOP or the 401k, lies about the union forcing workers to go out on strike, not having a choice or a vote in that, lectures about mandatory union dues and dues checkoff, all the union wanted was the money from the workers, threats of a possible plant closure, statements that it would take 12 months or longer to negotiate a contract and there would be no raises or anything or any benefit improvements from the company until then. And then there was an employee engagement survey. In these mandatory meetings, I witnessed most of my coworkers afraid to speak or ask any questions. Those of us who did speak up were treated like we didn't have knowledge of what we were talking about or even the right to ask the questions. I also witnessed a Hispanic worker who was a supporter of the union and a yes vote for us made to translate the company's anti-union message to another Hispanic co-worker during one of these mandatory meetings as the plant manager sat beside him and looked over his shoulder. to listen. I was also made to attend two-on-one meetings with the plant and HR managers where I was questioned about what improvements I felt the company could make to keep me from voting yes for the union. And I know that the other workers were subjected to these same two-on-one meetings as well. Again, we discussed it in the lunchrooms and break rooms, and these tactics scared the people. We were not given a choice whether or not to attend these meetings. In the case of the survey, two-on-one meetings, workers who were off work on vacation or disability were called back in and made to fill out these surveys so that the company had 100% compliance. These meetings cut into our work time, they cut into vacation time, and they were used to intimidate workers so that they would support the company's opinion. I'm here today to ask that you support the Senate Bill 519. If you have any questions or further information is needed, don't hesitate to call me.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name's Tom Chamberlain, and I'm president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, representing over 225,000 working Oregon families. Senate Bill 519 isn't a union bill. Senate Bill 519 is a workers' bill. It's a common sense bill that protects workers while in no way limiting the free speech of the employer. 90% of Oregonians aren't even aware that an employer can have a mandatory meeting on religion or politics or unionizing. 84% support legislation that would prohibit a worker from being terminated or disciplined for not attending such a meeting. This bill does not hurt employers or limit their rights in any way unless they're already planning on disciplining or firing workers who choose not to attend meetings on these topics. Oregonians go to work. We do a good job. We take home a paycheck. We support our families. And we depend on the business sector. We are not anti-business. This bill is not about anti-business. We want business to survive and thrive in the state of Oregon. We buy their services, we buy their products, and they supply the jobs that makes the gears go around in our economy. We recognize that. We also know that the employers have the right to discipline, to terminate, to set hours, and to have meetings to talk about a wide range of subjects. This bill does nothing to stop that. But with that power to terminate, to fire, to set hours, with that power causes a great influence on the workers. How they think, how they believe, should not be subject to the employer. The employer can have a meeting under this bill. They can talk about religion. They can talk about politics. They can talk about candidates. All this bill does is say, we have the right not to listen. We have the right to leave the meeting. That's all this bill does. We urge your support for Senate Bill 519.
Thank you. Any questions for this group? You're good. Thank you. Next, Tim I'm going to say Bernasik, I know I'm wrong, but and Barry Bichu.
Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Bernasik. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Dunn, Carney, Allen, Higgins, and Tongue up in Portland, and I'm legal counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau. And my client, the Oregon Farm Bureau, strongly opposes Senate Bill 519A. And I'd like to, with my time, walk through some of the provisions of the bill and explain why, in response to Senator Rosenbaum's questions that she previewed, some concerns that would be raised. And I'd like to follow up in some detail, if you would allow me, to explain the concerns, the technical problems with the bill that that can be fixed and could be addressed by this committee, and some constitutional issues that frankly cannot be fixed. First of all, I'd like to start out with the technical problem in the bill. If you look at Section 2, Sub 1A, the problem in the operative provisions of the bill is that there is no causation requirement as the bill is written. I don't know if it was intended or not, but what it basically creates, the way the bill is written, is a protected class of employees who employers cannot take any adverse employment action against if this employee fails to attend a mandatory meeting, even if the reason for that adverse employment action is completely unrelated to whether they attended the meeting or not. And here's how it works. If you read Section 2.1, it says an employer basically cannot take any adverse employment action against an employee, sub A, who declines to attend or participate in an employer-sponsored meeting or communication if the primary purpose of the meeting or communication is political or religious matters. It does not say because the employee declines to attend. It just simply says an employee who declines to attend that mandatory meeting. So, for example, maybe you do have the classic case of a union organizing campaign where employers have traditionally called captive audience meetings or mandatory meetings of employees to explain what unionization would mean in the workforce. This employee decides that they will not attend that meeting later, maybe a day later, a week later, whatever else, has some action, violates some provision of their employment agreement or whatever else, and is discharged. A strict reading of this bill says, well, that person is basically protected because they declined to attend that meeting. So I think, and if you look, interestingly, under Section 2.1c, you do see a causation element in the bill where it talks about the employer cannot discharge or take an adverse employment action against an employee because the employee makes a good faith oral report about a violation or suspected violation. So anyway, that's one of the technical problems with the bill, is the essential protected class that's created simply for failing to attend a meeting. And it would take a fix of simply adding the words, because the employee, strike who, and add, because the employee declines to attend or participate in a meeting. And based on the testimony that we heard earlier, it doesn't seem like such an amendment would run afoul of the purpose as stated by the proponents in earlier testimony. One other problem with the bill that employers have, well, there are many problems, but another one I'd like to highlight is in Section 2, Sub 2, where we talk about the damage provisions. What it talks about, if you go through all of the relief a court may provide, reinstatement, back pay, and on, the last sentence on line 15, the court shall award prevailing employee treble damages together with reasonable attorney fees and costs. There's no discretion allowed there. It's a mandatory requirement that the damages be treble damages, attorney fees, and costs. And that's a very frightening provision won't get into too much detail here, but if when some of the parameters of the bill are really unclear as to what is a mandatory communication, what is a mandatory meeting, some of these provisions that are unclear. Next, I'd like to address some of the constitutional issues that were raised. One is the free speech problem in this bill. As many of you know, Oregon has a reputation for one of the strongest free speech provisions in its state constitutions in the United States. The Oregon Supreme Court has been very jealous guardian of the ability of free speech for whatever reason, and content-based restrictions have almost unanimously been stricken unless under a broad, narrow historical purpose exemption that I won't go into detail today, but I want to explain why this bill violates Article 1, Section 8. It is because it is clearly content-based restrictions. What the bill provides is employers can have mandatory meetings on certain subjects. In fact, I'm very familiar. Other employers I represent are required to have mandatory meetings, OSHA meetings, safety, health, whatever else. So mandatory meetings are certainly permitted and, in fact, required under certain instances. So employers can hold mandatory meetings on certain subjects, but if you have a mandatory meeting on subjects of political issues or religious issues, it's you cannot basically have that employer, that mandatory meeting, because you can't take any adverse employment action for somebody who doesn't attend that meeting. So therefore, what you have clearly on the face of this statute is a content-based restriction. Mandatory meetings on certain subjects permitted, mandatory meetings on other subjects based on their content not permitted. A clear violation of Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Finally, the preemption argument under the National Labor Relations Act. And this is as Legislative Council has written on this issue, and Legislative Council is correct, this applies in a very narrow set of instances where the political speech would involve unionization, more likely in a union organizing campaign. And the issue here is the National Labor Relations Act has been held, although it under the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution, allows federal law to preempt state regulations in certain areas. There are several ways they can do that. Number one is express preemption. And unfortunately, the National Labor Relations Act does not expressly preempt state law. So then there have been numerous court cases in the Supreme Court, and the National Labor Relations Board has dealt with many cases dealing with, well, what are areas then that the National Labor Relations Act precludes regulation in the area of state or other kind of regulation? And one of those areas, it's called garment preemption, deals with the speech provisions in employer speech. And what that is Section 8C of the National Labor Relations Act. And quickly, I'll read that. And what 8C protects is the expressing of any view, argument, or opinion, or the dissemination thereof, shall not constitute or be evidence of an unfair labor practice under any provision of this act if, and this is important, if such expression contains no threat of reprisal or force of promise or benefit. So over the 70-plus years of the National Labor Relations Act, there has been a lot of litigation about where can states regulate in this area, and how does this work? And the rough balance that's been provided is, for example, employers can have mandatory meetings. These have been upheld numerous times in National Labor Relations Board decisions, Supreme Court decisions. These mandatory meetings are permitted and allowed as long as 8C provides, there's no threats or promise of benefit contained. In order to preserve the laboratory-type environment of the election process, employers are not allowed to have these meetings within 24 hours of the election. Now, the flip side is unions are provided, they're called Excelsior lists, addresses of the employees where they live, so unions may go to the homes of employees and talk about the benefits of unionization. Employers are prohibited from that type of activity. So there's extensive regulation in this area, and what the Supreme Court has said is, under the Garmin Doctrine, is where these areas have, where there's been such regulation, the federal law essentially occupies the field, and there's no room in these areas for state regulations to interfere. And that's where Senate Bill 519A runs into its constitutional problem, is it disallows, essentially, it disallows these mandatory meetings, because you can have voluntary meetings, but the idea is to have a captive audience speech where you talk to your employees about the benefits costs or concerns with unionization, as long as there's not promise of benefits or threats delivered. Now, the Legislative Council wrote, and in their opinion, thought that the Garmin preemption did not apply, and it's because the National Labor Relations Act didn't say that employees couldn't choose not to attend these meetings. So it's basically not been covered by the National Labor Relations Act, and so therefore, Senate Bill 519A does not run afoul of those provisions. And with all due respect to Legislative Council, I think that's an overly narrow view. The federal law is very clear that states cannot regulate clearly protected areas of speech, and I would argue that Section 8C probably clearly protects these types of mandatory meetings, but also says they can't regulate in areas that are arguably protected, because it's the province of the National Labor Relations Board, and if the National Labor Relations Board wants to allow employees to choose not to attend these meetings, then it's up to the NLRB, not state legislators, to decide whether or not that's permitted activity. So, again, I think it's an overly narrow interpretation by Legislative Council, and that's why I think you will see Senate Bill 519A does run afoul of the preemption doctrine under the Constitution. And as you know, we've had the question before, well, Tim, it's interesting, you represent, you know, farm groups, and farm groups aren't covered by the National Labor Relations Act, and so why is this a big issue to you, and why it's very important for the Farm Bureau and for the agricultural interests? I know OAN has expressed similar concerns, is that If this bill passes, and if it is challenged, which it will be, on these constitutional grounds, and if it is found for whatever reason to be upheld on the speech issues but is stricken under preemption, since agriculture, in spite of many, many years and attempts, some of you remember the battles we've had trying to get collective bargaining protection for Oregon agricultural employers and employees, since we're not covered by the National Labor Relations Act, we would not be preempted by this law. And so when we're dealing with unionization, the only industry that would be affected would be agriculture. And that's why we're so very concerned about this bill moving forward and really asking for you to pause and consider the ramifications here. One final note before I turn it over to Barry Bashu, the president of the Farm Bureau, for his testimony is it is interesting to me in hearing the testimony of the individuals that came up before that talked about these abuses that occurred during employer meetings and what they had to withstand. And one thing that was clear in the testimony is that there were threats of what was going to happen by the family oil company if the union came in. And that clearly, under the National Labor Relations Act, the ability to organize is protected under Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act. And any infringement on that and any threat or promise under Section 8C is an unfair labor practice and should be that type of activity is prohibited already under the law and should be dealt with there. The other issue is if employers are, and I have had the opportunity to advise employers in the unionization context, and these mandatory meetings must be handled with a great deal of care because certainly you want to express your concerns and make sure employees have information before they make their decision about whether or not to unionize. If you routinely have these meetings and have the effect that the proponents of the legislation carried, the end of the day is those employees are the ones that get to vote and decide the fate of union representation on the workforce. So if you continually have these meetings, you're ending up shooting yourself in the foot, and you end up not perhaps having the effect that you would want to have. So again, although mandatory meetings are permitted and permissible, employers need to be very careful in how they use them because, again, the end of the day, it's the employees wants to decide. So with that, I would be very happy to, if there are any questions or concerns or comments about the issues that we raised, I'd be very happy to address those. But if not, I'll turn it over to Barry Bashu, President of the Oregon Farm Bureau.
And we'll take questions right afterwards. So, Barry.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Barry Bashu. For the record, I farm near Boring, Oregon, and raise a diversity of crops. I'm also the elected president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. This legislative session has seen a lot of potential regulatory policy. Farm Bureau has concerns about the cost of many of these regulations and our economic viability. Some of them we have addressed and some of them we have not. But Senate Bill 519A is particularly unpalatable, with the result, intended or not, of assuming that all employers are bad actors and then codifying that in legislation. It puts yet another regulatory cost and legal risk on employers that are already struggling to maintain a workforce and economic stability to avoid adding to the almost 250,000 people that are already unemployed in this state under current anti-business climates. We need our employees, and we're particularly proud of the relationship that we have with those employees. I am in the third generation of families that have worked for me. That has not come without hard work and sacrifice on their part and on our part as a family farming operation. And I think I'm very representative of the people in the Oregon Farm Bureau and other agricultural employers. We work hand in hand with these people on a daily basis. We're in the fields all the time. We're picking, we're harvesting, we're moving stuff around, we're shearing, we're shipping. And we work with them all the time. As a mere result of that relationship and the mere fact that part of being employed is showing up to work, they're already in effect under what you could call and could be classed as a mandate. So if we're working with five or six people at a time, you know, not long ago, the entire nation spoke about nothing except the presidential election. It was in the papers. It was in the radio. It was on blogs. It was tweeted. It was tweeted. This bill could put me in a position of having to say to these people, I can't talk about that. I can't talk about increased taxes. I can't talk about the Oberstar bill in the United States Congress. I can't talk about estate taxes. I can't talk about water legislation. I can't talk about pesticide legislation, because by the mere fact that we are there together, in order to do that, I would have to excuse anybody who didn't want to hear whatever response it was that was asked of me, or, in fact, other employees. You know, I had to kind of giggle to myself in response to some of the previous testimony that this is clearly a simple and common sense bill. Well, there is absolutely nothing simple about the workplace. You know, people are incredibly complex, and the relationships that they share with their families and in their workplace is part and parcel of navigating employment and business. Employers and employees who choose to ignore those relationships will not be successful in their venture. We already have legislation. We already have national statute that deals with the issues that many of the previous speakers have spoken about. I feel sorry for them. I don't know the people that employ them. I don't know all the facts about the allegations that were made, but it seems clear to me that there's an issue there. But there's ability to address those issues. For most businesses, the minority of employers that use negative tax attacks will find negative results. It also provides, the NLRA provides remedies for disinfected employees currently, and we should be looking to those existing statutes to deal with them. This is frankly nothing more than a politically motivated solution looking for legitimacy by creating a problem. The core concern here is precluding open and transparent discussion between employees and employers. I ask myself why this legislative body would want to stifle this. Why would we preclude employees from having full disclosure and information on issues impacting them in their workplace? With regard to unionization, why would public policymakers only want employees to have half of the story? I think there's an assumption here that employees are not capable of determining fact from fiction. I think that is an incredibly biased indictment on the workforce in the state of Oregon. I have much more pride in the people that work for me than apparently some people who are pushing for this legislation appear to have. What is a mandatory meeting? I work hand in hand with my employees. We talk about everything. The entire nation talked about the presidential campaign. I would have to stop that. I guess I would stop and complete my testimony by saying that, once again, we're particularly proud of the agricultural business community in this state. I am very concerned about its future. We face continual attempts to regulate us out of business, very little, if any, recognition for the value that we bring to the state, to its environment, to its economic viability. This is yet another particularly egregious, punitive piece of legislation which will make it more and more difficult for me to continue to hire, expand, and maintain a good working relationship, for which I thank daily my employees for helping me do. I do not want to be put in a position of not being able to work, play, and share family, business, and politics with those people that have made my life so good for three generations. With that, I close and we'll take any questions you may have.
Any questions? Representative Berger.
This is painful, Mr. Chair.
I know. She had a problem today with her voice.
And I don't know if these are the gentlemen to answer this question, but I'd like to put it out there in Section 1, Sub 1, Line 5 of the bill. It defines constituent group, civic associations, community groups, social clubs, mutual benefit funds, and labor organizations. And then in Sub 5, political matters include constituent group or activity. My concern is this, that with that broad constituent group language and that being political matters, I can envision where an employer at a mandatory meeting says, we got to support the food share, which is a civic group, or we got to give to United Way as a group, which is a civic organization. And that would be, under this law, political speech. Now, I appreciate the union folks have what their grievance is in terms of being hammered on, but I'm very concerned that the language of this is so broad that it would preclude a lot of speech in a meeting that the legal consequences of that. Enough said. You may not be the ones to answer this, but...
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, my only comment would be to say I think you're right. There, that's just one issue of the breadth of this bill, and when you couple that with the unreasonable penalties of treble damages, in addition to a whole host of other discretionary damages, but a plaintiff would get treble damages, attorney fees, and costs. Employers can be very concerned about what they can and cannot say and where they may or may not run afoul of this legislation. I think you're absolutely correct.
Any other questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
J.L. Wilson, Jim Gardner, Jenna Kovaza. I said that right. But I'm sure you can correct me when you come up.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, for the record, J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. We are strongly opposed to Senate Bill 519. More than any other bill this session, our employers are, there's a palpable level of frustration, I would even say anger and disappointment surrounding Senate Bill 519. To them, it feels punitive, gratuitous. It tilts the balance of labor communications in a way that has not been done in any other state. I want to make very clear, no other state has this law. It's been said that New Jersey has a law similar, so we'd be the second state, but I want to clarify that New Jersey's law deals specifically with religion and politics. The piece dealing with labor communications is specifically excluded from that bill. The Oregon bill is unique. It's one of a kind. I also want to make clear that these so-called captive audience meetings are federally protected meetings. When you talk about labor communications, this is the employer venue. This is what the employers have to make their case, so long as there's not threat of reprisal or promise of benefit. This is the purview of the employer. This has been upheld basically by the courts because it's been recognized that employees do not need to be shielded against what the employer thinks so long as there are no threats or promises made. This is the employer venue. On the flip side, you have the labor venue. They have access to workers outside of the workplace. They have names. They have phone numbers. They have addresses. Those meetings take place outside of the workplace. They are every bit, I'm guessing, as intense as the employer meetings. But these are the two competing venues, and they've been carefully crafted as such. And my suggestion is there is no imbalance of communication here that this bill remedies. The dangerous thing about Senate Bill 519 to us, the practical effect of which is it creates a new protected class of employees. Employees who do not want to attend these meetings or do not want to receive an employer communication. And that's not even defined in the bill what a communication is. But there's a new protected class of employees, not based on immutable characteristics, not race, not gender, not religious affiliation, but on whether or not they wanted to attend an employer meeting. And as Senator Burdick said on the Senate floor, this is a devastating liability for employers in this state to have this type of new protected class, especially when you talk about the penalties that are levied in the bill. Under federal law, the penalties for an unfair labor practice, you've got reinstatement and back pay. Under this, you have quote-unquote all appropriate relief, including reinstatement and back pay, but treble damages, attorney's fees, and the list goes on. These are punitive punitive damages that subject employees, or employers, I would say, to what I would consider devastating liability. And this is something that really needs to be addressed in the bill. The bill is unconstitutional in not one, but perhaps two ways, both federally and the state, as was outlined by Mr. Bernasik, and Jim will go further into that. And we've talked somewhat a lot about the labor component, but I also want to touch briefly on the political and the religious component. On the political, we have a number of Oregon companies who communicate to their employees regarding legislation that is vital to their business, vital to their industry, ballot measures that have a direct impact on the viability of these companies. Now, whether you agree with these companies or not, you have to admit we're better for that level of communication and participation. Why would an employer engage in that level of participation and communication today, given the liability that now exists under Senate Bill 519? And finally, with regard to the religious component, whether you know it or not, there are many, many, many faith-based companies in Oregon. Companies that are founded on the principles or teachings of Jesus Christ, that make clear that they are service-based companies based on religious principles. You are putting them in a position with this bill that they cannot even require an employee to sign an employment handbook or a code of conduct, because this would be a religious communication. And to expose employers to liability for this purpose, that they can't even require a signature on a code of conduct or an employment handbook, I don't really think is what you intend to do. So we oppose Senate Bill 519. There are many speakers other than me that wish to speak, so I'll end it here.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenna Kaluza. I need to write my name a little clearer. And I'm with NFIB, that's the National Federation of Independent Business here in Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I'm here in opposition of the bill. Many of our concerns have already been stated, but I just want to highlight a few to you. There are several portions of the bill that we believe have negative effects on small business. Under Section 2, we do not see what constitutes participation in an employer-sponsored meeting. There are several unanswered questions as to what is defined as a meeting and how an employee can opt out of those meetings. For small businesses, it can be very difficult to determine the primary purpose of a meeting. Oftentimes, the meetings in small businesses are few and far between. Employees can be called together on one subject matter, and a simple question can derail the meeting's primary purpose onto another subject matter. We're not clear what employer-sponsored communication can mean. This is too broad and leaves many of my members at the risk of breaking the law unintentionally. The penalties under this bill will severely damage small business. Under Section 2 of the bill also, it says the court shall award a prevailing employee treble damages together with reasonable attorney fees and costs. During difficult economic times, this exposes my members, the small business owners in our state, to costly lawsuits from disgruntled employees. Employees of small businesses often turn to their employers for questions relating to their industry. This can be as simple as a store clerk asking how they place orders, but it can also be an employee asking what a ballot measure means to the future of their industry or their job. Regulating the communication between employers and employees turns one against the other, and we feel that it's a solution looking for a problem. We urge you to consider the adverse effects this has on small business, and thank you again.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today in my capacity as a partner in the law firm of Gardner & Gardner. As some of you know, when the legislature is not in session, I practice law, and an area in which I specialize is state constitutional law, primarily in the context of ballot measure litigation. And it is in that capacity that JL asked me to take a look at this bill, specifically under the category of Article 1, Section 8. As was testified previously, Article 1, Section 8, which is the state counterpart to the First Amendment, has been interpreted by our Supreme Court to enjoy unusual breadth and strength in a variety of contexts, and in particular with respect to what is called content-based classification or content-based discrimination. And normally you might think, well, this is a topic that should be just addressed to our Supreme Court. It's a matter for lawyers and judges exclusively. But I would respectfully suggest that the first obligation of this legislature is to ask itself whether a proposed law that it is considering enacting is constitutional. Does it meet, does it satisfy our fundamental charter? Is it consistent with Article 1, Section 8, and other provisions? And so in that spirit, I want to lead you through some of the key decisions and why I think this particular bill clearly runs afoul of Article 1, Section 8. As a prefatory matter, I'd like to add this is a topic that Legislative Council did not address. Their opinion is exclusively focused on the federal preemption issue. So the Article 1, Section 8 issue is not addressed in the LC opinion. In a long line of decisions, beginning with State versus Robertson and culminating most recently in the 2006 decision of Oregon Media Dimensions, our Supreme Court has consistently ruled that Article 1, Section 8 prohibits lawmakers from enacting restrictions that focus on the content of speech or writing, either because that content is deemed to be socially undesirable or offensive, or because it is thought to have adverse consequences. In that most recent decision, that rule was applied to invalidate a restriction on outdoor advertising on the ground that the legislature's decision to limit one of those types of expression, in this case off-premises signs, more stringently than the other because of its content is an impermissible restriction on the subject of expression under Article 1, Section 8. Under the principles of Robertson and these progeny cases, Senate Bill 519 would, if enacted, violate Article 1, Section 8. In the words of the Oregon Supreme Court's decision in Outdoor Media, Senate Bill 519A would distinguish between messages on the basis of what they say and permit an employer to require attendance at certain types of meetings that are intended to communicate a message, but not at other types of meetings intended to communicate a message solely because of the content of the message. And if I can just give one brief example of that. While Senate Bill 519A would prohibit an employer from requiring employees to attend a meeting, the primary purpose of which was to communicate the employer's opinion regarding the political aspects of the global warming debate, nothing in the bill would prohibit an employer from requiring employees to attend a meeting, the primary purpose of which was to communicate the employer's opinion regarding the scientific, economic, or environmental aspects of the global warming debate. And that, in a nutshell, is content-based discrimination and classification, pure and simple. It runs afoul of Article 1, Section 8.
Other questions, Representative Gard?
Not a question, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I asked to be excused. I have another committee meeting coming up.
And I do know that. Thank you. Yep. Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all for being here. Megan Moyer.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer, and I'm with the Service Employee International Union, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 519A. And I really would like to go back to some issues that have come up in testimony around what this bill would prohibit an employer from saying. And I'd like to clarify that this bill does not prohibit an employer from saying anything. This bill pertains to an employee's right. And the right to, if being forced at a mandatory meeting, being talked about political issues, talked about anti-union issues, talking about very strong-held religious beliefs, that an employee can leave that meeting without the fear of termination. This is about employees. Employers can continue to say what they wish to say, but it's about an employee's right to not be forced
to listen to things that are not relevant to somebody's work. A couple issues that came up is I'm not going to be able to talk to my coworkers about politics or about the presidential election. There is a huge distinction between a water cooler conversation, something that's happening at a company picnic, where an employee who is uncomfortable with that conversation can simply politely excuse themselves because they don't wish to participate, and being forced in a meeting to sit and listen where the intent is very clear to persuade on issues not relevant to their employment or the functions of their job. Also, the issue came up about the right of employers to communicate freely. And the U.S. Supreme Court in Hill versus Colorado, which is a 2000 ruling, stated that does protect the right of a listener from some unwanted communication. So the right of free speech is not a right to a captive audience. It is a right to say whatever your viewpoint is. And this bill does not in any way infringe upon that. An employer has the right to espouse their religious beliefs, even if it makes somebody uncomfortable. They have the right to espouse their views on the formation of a union, but they cannot do it in a way where somebody is forced to be there, and then if that person opts to remove themselves because they are so uncomfortable with the content of that conversation, that they would be subject to termination because they remove themselves. That employer could still hold those views. They could even be saying those. It's about the employee saying, this is so uncomfortable to me that I need to remove myself from this without the fear that I'm going to be fired. I think, although I'm here speaking for SEIU Local 503, we represent a variety of workers, both public sector and private sector, many in the nonprofit world. And many of our workers are very mission-driven, although none of them are actually in a religious organization. They're very mission-driven and passions are high, and that's completely part of doing work that is of service to others. But we have certainly had our experiences where workers have been forced into captive audience meetings where they were told all the consequences that can happen if you join the union. People were villainized from their support. They were not team players. These are not conversations that are void of a power dynamic, and I think that's what's important here. Is it one situation to be having a conversation at a water cooler or in a setting in the workplace, and it is another to be in a captive situation and being spoken to about issues such as religion, such as how one ought to vote, such as how they ought to vote in a union election. When they are not free to speak freely, they are not free of fear of termination. And that's what this is really about. It's not about what someone can't say. They can say what do they want. It's about an employee's right to remove themselves from a situation without fear of termination. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Andy Easton, Tom Russell, Dave Fiscom.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, Director of Advocacy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And with me today is Tom Russell, the President and CEO of Adventist Medical Center, and Dave Fiscom, representing Providence Health Services. On behalf of our 58 member hospitals who employ over 55,000 full-time and part-time employees, we oppose Senate Bill 519A. You have heard the legal and constitutional concerns. We would like to bring it down to a real-world effects of this bill that would have on our members. Communicating core values to our employees is an important part of our hospital's efforts to unify employees around a common vision for healthcare. Many, if not all, of our Oregon hospitals have religious and faith-based roots. their missions, which are reflected in their origins, is core to who they are and what they do. Hospitals also have a social obligation to be advocates for the uninsured and to improve access to health care services for all. In addition to our employees being dedicated to the health of their patients, their hospitals, and their communities, they are often eager for more information that promotes these values. This is very true in 2007 with ballot measure 50, the Healthy Kids Initiatives. The Oregon Hospital Association took a major role in promoting that with its members, which in turn engaged their employees on that ballot measure. Hospitals would never support requiring employees to sit through a meeting at which they were forced to adhere to a particular religious or political point of view. However, under Senate Bill 519A, our hospital members would need to be very careful of how they communicate with their employees on religious and political issues going forward. We are concerned that this bill set hospitals up to defend every meeting at which a religious or political issue was discussed in the anticipating of a future lawsuit. At this time, I'll turn it over to Tom Russell, who will talk about how this bill would change the way he communicates with his employees.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Tom Russell, and I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer at Adventist Medical Center in Portland, Oregon. We're a 302-bed faith-based hospital with over 2,000 employees, and we have over 345,000 visits a year from members of our community. I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 519A because I believe it restricts our freedom of speech and consequently will curtail our ability to speak to our employees about the very core of why we exist. Fundamentally, my concern stems from my belief in our constitutional right to free speech. We've had heard discussions of Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution. In essence, this bill that we're discussing today selectively restricts certain employer-employee communication based solely on the content of that communication. I believe this is unlawful under the Oregon Constitution. So why is this important to us? It's important because patients we serve expect and demand that effective spiritual care be offered to support our clinical staff in the provision of their care. Senate Bill 519A will prevent us from collaborating with our employees on the reason for the existence of our organization, and that is to demonstrate the human expression of the healing ministry of Jesus Christ. This mission is only accomplished as our staff incorporate physical, mental, and spiritual healing in the care that our staff provides. To assure this happens consistently, we must be able to train our staff in mission and values. On June 1, as part of our required employer orientation, I led a discussion with our new employees to communicate our mission and explain how we expect each employee to implement that mission in their work. We discussed the hospital's faith origins and purposefully incorporate these issues of spirituality and values in our work to assure that our behaviors and our interactions with each other and with our patients demonstrate Christ's compassion, care, and healing. Under Senate Bill 519A, I would be prohibited from having these discussions in a required forum. We do not mandate that personal religious views of our employees are held in any particular direction. We simply ask that our staff be sensitive to the broad range of spiritual needs of our constituents. Our employees are hired with an expectation that they will understand and embrace the mission of our organization. In fact, many of our employees seek us out because of our mission. Our employees demonstrate deep support for the mission of the organization, in fact, rating it the highest among all the elements of the work environment. Our employee retention, their longevity of service, are both a testament that the mission of whole person care at Adventist Medical Center is important to them. Senate Bill 519A will prevent us from engaging in dialogue with our own employees about a culture that they themselves value. Spiritual care matters in our community as well, our patients and your voters. On May 2007, the Archives of Surgery published a study demonstrating that nationally 94% of patients thought their physician should inquire about their spiritual beliefs if they became gravely ill. Yet only 32% of the patients reported that their physician ever inquired about their spiritual needs. So you can see we have a long way to go. And to make that happen, as a healthcare provider, we must have conversations about these issues. And we believe it's our obligation to assure that our staff and our physicians meet the expectations of our patients.
Thank you.
Our area residents demonstrated their support for spiritual care when they contributed over $6 million to endow the chaplains program at Adventist Medical Center. From the research we've done, we believe we're the only hospital in the country that has endowed their chaplain services. I believe these are 6 million reasons why we're mandated to make sure that the mission is alive and well at Adventist Medical Center. And I ask that you carefully consider the unintended consequences of the bill before us today and the impact that it would have on our ability to collaborate with our employees about the spiritual care patients expect us to deliver. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. And if you have any questions, be glad to answer those.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon. It's nice to see you again.
Yes.
For the record, Dave Fiska, I'm here for Providence Health System. Just to remind you, Providence is a major health care provider in the state. We operate hospitals, other facilities in Portland, Medford, Hood River, Newburgh, Seaside, Mount Angel, Milwaukee. Today we have in the range of 15 or 16,000 employees statewide. We are a major health care provider, and that brings us to your committee today to testify against Senate Bill 519. I do so in particular by delivering to you a letter signed by Elizabeth McCabe, the Chief Mission Integration Officer for Providence Health and Services in Oregon. She could not be here today but asked me to speak in her behalf. And with your indulgence, Mr. Chair, I'll just read you a couple of paragraphs of her letter. The work of Providence then and today is to be a ministry guided by a mission that calls all of our employees as people of Providence to, quote, reveal God's love for all, especially the poor and vulnerable, through our compassionate service, end quote. Our mission is not to call anyone to promote any particular religious faith or belief. We seek to create and sustain a work environment that affirms and fosters respect for human diversity, and we place great importance on the rich diversity within our workplace. We welcome all people who share these priorities, regardless of their beliefs, to be part of this work. More than simply a right to exercise free speech, Providence views communications with our employees as an indispensable part of who we are and what our employees and patients value. Our representation to you today is that Senate Bill 519A in its current form would prevent us from conducting the kinds of meetings we have today, the approach we take with employees, which in fact on many occasions is to require their attendance, especially, for example, when they are new employees who are being oriented to what it means on a daily basis, on a practical level, to work at Providence Health System in Oregon. I want to emphasize one point that Ms. Easton made to you. One of the things that we did heavily in the last couple of years was meet with our employees, sometimes in mandatory meetings, to apprise them of issues associated with ballot measure 50, the tobacco tax that was designed to provide finance care for low-income Oregonians. We considered that to be a part of our mission to do so. We had a stake in the outcome of that. We didn't encourage employees to vote in any particular way about that. That's obviously their prerogative, just as we don't encourage employees to adopt any religious belief or dogma. But we did spend a lot of time, effort, and energy in promoting that public policy development for Oregon. Today, I was on a conference call for an hour with a key segment of our employee group in a mandatory meeting, if you will, to talk about public policy issues such as this one that you still face in this building, along with me as Providence's lobbyist here. This bill, we believe, is unnecessary, would restrict in an awkward way, if not an illegal way, our attempt to communicate routinely with our employees. And so for that reason, Mr. Chair, in the person of Ms. McCabe, I would encourage this bill not to move forward. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all.
Thank you for your attention.
Next, we have Jim Welch and Jeff Stone.
Chair Roblin, committee members, Jim Welch here for Oregon Cattlemen Association, Oregon State Grange, and Beef Northwest. You've heard all about Senate Bill 519, and we certainly are here to oppose this legislation also, but I won't reiterate the things that have been listed and passed on to you from the agriculture community. I'll just make a quick statement and say that we support so many of the things that and concerns that have been exchanged with you. We support the free exchange of information and a well-balanced labor relationship between employer and employee. We fear this legislation moves the scales of justice too far in the direction of protecting employees and in the direction of reducing the right of free speech for the employer. The unintended consequences of this legislation could place an undue burden on the agriculture community and my clients. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. You've heard lots of examples today, and you all look tired, and I know that everybody wants to escape this building as quickly as possible. But one thing I would add, you have testimony from the Oregon Association of Nurseries. There's a letter being handed out that has a bunch of the business groups at the letterhead at the top. There's also the Oregon Restaurant Association's letter that Bill Perry could not stay, and so I submitted that on his behalf. When my growers talk about this issue, it builds a fire of anger only in the sense that we feel that it impugns the integrity of growers that would mismanage a mandatory meeting. And for us, mandatory meetings are not called unless they're absolutely necessary because we have work to do. And mandatory meetings can be talked about safety, it can be talked about what we're digging that week. But also, during the height of the immigration debate 2 years ago, a lot of our employees came and said, what are we going to do? It affects me, it affects my family. What information can you share? How can I get involved? Now, they don't say we should be for or against. On ballot measures, they say, here's the state website. Go look at it. Make sure you vote. But to say that nursery and greenhouse industry owners misuse mandatory meetings is an affront to them. And so that's why we'd ask you to use an abundance of caution with this bill. We think that it has a lot of legal problems, and as Mr. Bernasek pointed out, we do feel that if it gets kicked out on the preemption, it will only apply to agriculture. And that's why we have such a strong feeling about this. We, like Mr. Bashu, who preceded, value our employees. And we have folks who have been with our nurseries for decades. So it is familial. So I would just ask caution by this committee. I think you've been given a lot of reasons why, how to exercise it, and I thank you for your time today.
Thank you both. Questions, anyone? Nope, it's getting into a rush.
Thank you.
Thanks. Joe Esmond. And if there's anyone else out there that would like to speak who has not, this is the last person who's signed up on our list. So
the pressure's on.
Yeah, the pressure's on. But if there's others, I just want to make sure that they have an opportunity to get their name down. Joe.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond. I am a business rep for the IBW, Local 48 in Portland, Oregon, and I'll be speaking today for the whole all the electricians, men and women of the IBW in the state of Oregon, just about 9,500. We are 100% behind the bill. We are not constitutional attorneys. We feel it's a good bill. We are not anti-business. This man, over here with Mr. Fiscom, we are part of his health care plan. A lot of our folks go there, small businesses. A lot of our contractors are small businesses. So, that being said, I just want to get that out in the open. And also, I haven't always been a union person, so I can see both sides of the fence. I have been a small business owner at one time. Wasn't very good at it. But that being said, there are a lot of places on the East Coast where people fled because they were forced to adhere to certain religious beliefs and certain political beliefs. We call them the Quakers, the Puritans, etc. I don't think there's a giant problem with all this. It just gives the employee the right not to attend, and that seems to be pretty reasonable to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
That ends the testimony today. I am at this time going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 519A. I also notice that we'll carry over the work session to tomorrow. I do want to acknowledge that we did get two amendments, and I want to make sure that that's on the record for here. So there is a -6 and a -7. I would encourage members of the committee to read those over and understand them, and we can decide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And so you understand what they are. I am not certain that they'll each be introduced or how it will happen, but they may be, and I think knowing them is good. We did get a couple pieces of information about 519 handed out today that were not in public testimony, and I would encourage people to read those so they understand the total, have a better understanding of this bill. And so is there any other discussion or comments for today? I appreciate the attentive nature of the people who were able to remain the whole time. We have revenue meetings that are happening. We have ways and means meetings that are happening. And some people had to get off to other times of the day, but I anticipate that this will be on our schedule tomorrow. And again, I know that people have some graduations and other things, so we'll try to do stuff early in the meetings tomorrow. So with that, I will close our rules meeting for today. Thank you all for being here.